Set your course for the Huff
Takes Podcast.
Welcome to Huff Takes. I'm Eric Geller.
I'm Grace Seegers.
And unfortunately, we don't have Haley Birdwell with us today. She's a new mom, so congratulations to her. She's taking some much-needed time off from, I assume, work, but also Huff Takes. So we're very much looking forward to having her back, but also watching her settle into this exciting new life. So we're very happy for her about that. And in this episode, we're going to continue a theme that we started last time with Grace's discussion of A New Hope, where we tried to bring something new to the conversation about a movie that everybody's seen 100 times. If you're listening to this podcast, you've probably watched these movies 100 times. We're going to continue with that theme today, talking about The Empire Strikes Back. And when I was rewatching this movie, Grace, obviously, you know, you notice all the things that everybody always notices in terms of I am your father and I love you, I know. But there were some other things in here that that I wanted to talk about with you, because I think that they're underappreciated aspects of The Empire Strikes Back. And one of the first ones, and this is not to say that these things never come up, but they are the less heralded aspects of the movie. We really start to see the gray of Star Wars in Empire Strikes Back. We start to see some nuance. Obviously, we are introduced to characters in A New Hope who represent that kind of middle space, but they're not really front and center, at least not too much in terms of their grayness. Han Solo is a smuggler, but he eventually ends up on Team Good Guys. In this movie, we see people who don't end the movie on Team Good or Team Bad, or at least if they do, their allegiance is still somewhat questionable. And there are two big examples. We have the Bounty Hunters, so we see them for the first time on the Star Destroyer. And we've got Lando Calrissian, who, you know, starts off his appearance in Star Wars making some pretty questionable decisions and ultimately, you know, ends up on the Millennium Falcon. But, you know, he gets there in a very circuitous way. When you were watching the movie, Grace, did this stand out to you as something that is notable for The Empire Strikes Back, the way that it takes us into kind of a new space of Star Wars, pun intended, that is not just about the good guys and the bad guys?
Yeah, definitely. One of my favorite things about Empire, and I think what makes it the best Star Wars movie ultimately, is the introduction of a little bit of complex morality, and where A New Hope is very much a straightforward hero's journey type of story, Empire Strikes Back is filled with these morally gray characters, like you mentioned, but also with our heroes, and particularly Luke Skywalker, making bad decisions. Like, Luke is the golden boy of the trilogy, and the first movie in the OT original trilogy, A New Hope, really kind of establishes him in that good guy role. And in Empire Strikes Back, of course, he still is very much the good guy, but he makes some dumb decisions. And we see that very much on Dagobah, where he is reckless and impatient, and Yoda is rightfully criticizing him for that and for not believing in himself or believing in the power of the Force, even more importantly. And for thinking that he needs to go save his friends instead of finishing his training, and valuing those personal relationships, being unwilling to let go of those personal relationships like his father was, and having that ultimately be the downfall of Anakin, and similarly close to the downfall of Luke. So I think it is a very interesting movie in how it takes that main character from the first movie and then is like, actually, he's not that great, and he's going through it and making some questionable choices. So I think that's very interesting and kind of ties into what you were saying about this moral complexity, because it's also kind of adding complexity to the characters that are very one note in A New Hope and then get a little bit more depth in Empire.
Yeah, I love that point that you made about about Luke, and let's talk a little bit about him. I do want to bounce back to Lando in a few minutes, but the thing I find so great about Luke in this movie is he spends pretty much all the time on Dagobah doubting and denying and just not being a believer in the Force, in Yoda. You know, what he fails to do, you know, both with the cave and with the X-Wing is all about a lack of trust in this power that he can't necessarily see. He certainly knows that he has it, but he does not understand it very well, and he doesn't trust it, really. And you see that when Yoda says, you don't need your weapons, and he takes them with him anyway, because if you were Luke in that situation, you're presented with this scary place, you would probably bring your weapons because you would approach this from a very conventional perspective of, I'm going into a place I've never been before. It seems kind of dangerous. I want to protect myself. And of course, what Yoda knows that Luke doesn't is that any danger that you face in there is going to be from within your own mind. He has experience with this place and he knows that. Luke has no idea, and so he does what anybody would do. But that is ultimately a failure of trust in Yoda, in his master. And we sort of see something similar with the X-Wing where, you know, he can tap into this power if he just trusts it and he trusts that it is all-encompassing in the way that Yoda talks about. But ultimately, he doesn't really trust it at this point. And his own doubts affect him to a great degree in this case and really prevent him from doing what Yoda is ultimately able to do. And even afterwards, he says, you know, basically he says, I don't understand how this is possible. And it's because, as Yoda says, he's thinking about it in this very conventional way of, big ship, I'm not that strong, I don't understand how to do that. And of course, Yoda is really the only one there who understands that the ship is no bigger than a rock to the Force. And this is all just about Luke, not yet, you know, his mind is not molded yet to really understand the nuances and the power of the Force. And by the time of Return of the Jedi, he's a lot more zen about this kind of thing. He's a lot more comfortable and confident. But what we see here is a character who has that Skywalker impetuousness and is really primed to make a lot of bad decisions. And, you know, as I was watching Obi-Wan and Yoda kind of try to talk Luke out of it at the end of his time on Dagobah, I was thinking, you know, they've been here before. I mean, they have both dealt with an impetuous, headstrong Anakin Skywalker. And of course, we all know where that ended up. It is really interesting to watch this movie after the prequels and the Clone Wars because, you know, you get this kind of retroactive depth to their concerns in a way that, you know, obviously was not really the case at the time of The Empire Strikes Back. However, there is some dialogue that alludes to the fact that this is what they're worried about. They don't connect Vader to Anakin, but they do say that they lost Vader. And so you do understand that they're thinking about some past failure. So I just think that it is really well played in terms of just how it's organized. And I do have to give a shout out, obviously, to Mark Hamill for making Yoda seem so alive. I'm far from the first person to say this, of course, but you only believe that he is wrestling with these lessons from this strange little creature because he makes you believe. And he does a great job at that.
Right. Yeah, I think Yoda is such an interesting character in this, particularly looking at it from the perspective of having watched the prequels and the Clone Wars, because at this point, Yoda is a figure in exile, self-imposed exile, and someone who has failed. And so that's where a lot of his hesitancy in training Luke comes from, is because he failed with Anakin. He knows he failed. And he doesn't want to go through that again. And I'm glad that you brought up the cave scene, because that has one of my favorite lines from Yoda. I mean, obviously, Yoda is an iconic quote machine. But when Luke is about to go into the cave, Luke asks, "What's in there?" And Yoda says, "Only what you take with you." And I think that really shows how it's not just that Luke doesn't trust in Yoda, it's that he doesn't trust in himself, and he doesn't trust himself to handle what's in there without his weapons. And going into the cave and having ultimately who he is facing is Darth Vader, but it's what himself is what he's afraid of. He's afraid of his own power, his own darkness, his own fears and doubts, and that just compounds those doubts. And then we see that again with his failure to lift the X-Wing, and then Yoda shows him that he could have lifted the X-Wing when Yoda lifts it. And Luke says, "I can't believe it." And Yoda, again with the iconic quotes, says, "That is why you fail." It's not just because he doesn't believe in the Force or believe in Yoda. It's because he doesn't believe in himself, I think. That despite being the big hero, he's still in his head an underdog and doesn't have the faith in himself and in his connection to the Force. And that's why he fails on Dagobah. And I think ultimately when he faces Darth Vader, that's why he fails there as well, because he doesn't trust in himself. He's there because he knows he wants to save his friends, but ultimately he's just clouded by doubt throughout the fight. And then when that doubt is confirmed at the end, where Vader is like, "No, I am your father," that really kind of confirms to Luke that all of the reasons that he had to doubt himself were very valid and real, and it's devastating for him. Like, I would throw myself off an electrical array too, you know? That's a bummer. But I think Luke is such an interesting character in this movie, and by the end it looks like he's kind of beginning to come to terms with his own doubts, and he's looking towards the future, looking out the window with Leia at what's coming next. But in order to get to that sense of peace that he has at the end, he really needed to kind of fall down and fail a lot along the way.
Yeah, and you know, something that really came into focus for me watching the movie this time around is everybody remembers, you know, "No, I am your father." What is lost a little bit in the discussion of that moment is the lead up to that, which is, you know, you don't know the power of the dark side. Obi-Wan never told you what happened to your father. And think about what he's really saying there, right? He's saying, you probably think that your father was this good guy who was stabbed in the back by a red lightsaber that I was holding. But really what happened was I was seduced by the dark side, corrupted by the dark side, and now I'm trapped by the dark side. And so you should be very afraid of the dark side, because it can turn your father into the person you see in front of you, right? It can create me. And so you need to respect this power. You need to stop thinking you can defeat it. And this, you know, this is paid off isn't the right term, but it is followed up in Return of the Jedi by a much wiser Luke saying, "Join me, come with me, let's get out of here, I can save you." And Vader says, "It's too late for me, son," which is, I think, for audiences in the 80s, just this fascinating idea that the character who is the archetype of evil and remorseless killing understands that there is a spectrum of good and evil, that there is a spectrum of defensible and indefensible behavior, and that he is on the wrong end of it. And it's not that he necessarily likes it. It's that he himself feels trapped. He recognizes that, like, he has gone off the deep end, and that a person in better shape might actually want to step away from this, but he cannot do that. I think that is such an interesting way of looking at Vader. It is certainly not the Darth Vader that we meet in A New Hope, but Empire is the first time you get a glimpse of the idea that he might actually, you know, first of all, that there's a person in there. I mean, this is the first time we see his skin on his Star Destroyer. But second, that he actually thinks about things in a similar way to how we do, you know, that, oh, this is this bad guy and he's doing things that are bad, as opposed to, I think a lot of people in the 70s are used to this kind of the more Buck Rogers style of, you know, robot villain who doesn't have that self-awareness to recognize that they are doing something bad and is just sort of very much set in their ways, and they like what they're doing. They think what they're doing is right. They have their twisted evil plan. Well, Darth Vader, as we discover starting in this movie, is not like that.
Right. And I think a lot of what he's saying to Luke in that moment too is, you know, I was trapped by the dark side, which means you can and will also be trapped by the dark side, which was Luke's fear in the cave, essentially.
Right.
And is his fear whenever he tries to tap into the Force is that he feels, he does feel the seduction of the dark side, just like Anakin did. And having Darth Vader be like, yeah, this happened to me and I'm your dad, so it'll probably happen to you too, so you should just give in right now and we'll take over the galaxy together. That's a really devastating moment, I think, and you can really see it when Luke does the screaming, the much maligned, but I think realistic in that scenario, screaming, no, no, that's not true, that's impossible, because that is really him accepting it and acknowledging it, even as he says it's not true. It's him realizing and having it click in his mind, like, oh, this is true. This explains a lot about me, and maybe I should be afraid of myself. So I think it's a very nuanced story in a way that doesn't often get appreciated because it's kind of obscured by the iconicism of the no, I am your father line and the big twist. And because that's so well known now, we, I guess, kind of forget the pathos underneath it all, and the significant emotional undercurrent that makes the moment work.
Yeah, the reveal is almost an aside in the service of the warning about the dark side. He's basically saying, look, I started out as your father, and then I became this monster, and that is why the dark side is so powerful. But of course, the actual reveal itself is just, as a matter of cinema, it gets all the attention. But for Vader, you know, he wants to shock Luke into realizing what can happen to a person. And so I think, yeah, you're right that is... that is a moment that really sticks some doubt into Luke's gut, and, you know, makes him realize that Yoda was right, that the dark side might not be stronger, but it is a slippery slope if you start drawing on this power. And a person who is as good as Anakin Skywalker started out to be can be pushed off the ledge with the right provocation.
I have a question. So this is tangentially related. But as I'm rewatching it, after Luke leaves, Dagobah and Yoda and Obi-Wan are talking, and Obi-Wan's like, that boy is our last hope, and Yoda says, no, there is another.
Yeah, he's talking about Leia, by the way.
Yeah, he is talking about Leia, but...
No, I'm just kidding. I thought I was, like, making a joke about that being your question, but go ahead.
Yes, that's my question. But that is kind of my question. Do you think that that was the initial intention of George Lucas in this movie, that Leia was the another that he was talking about? Because you'd think that, or I always feel like when I watch it, Yoda saying, no, there is another. And then in the next movie, we find out that Leia is Luke's twin. But the third movie / sixth movie, Return of the Jedi, doesn't really do anything with that. Like, it doesn't go have her also be a Jedi then, or explain her greater connection to the Force. So I don't know. I always feel like, was that really intended to be Leia? Because it just doesn't feel like something that they really develop enough. Or maybe I'm just reading too much into it. What do you think?
Well, I mean, we do see that she's Force sensitive because she senses Luke's distress and she guides them right to him. So I don't know who else it would be. I put it in the show notes that I think, you know, not having Leia have her powers explored in the movies was a missed opportunity. That being said, the movies follow a fairly straightforward template of the hero's journey, and it's not often that you can pull off a movie with two hero's journeys at once, and the only other really way to do it is to just have Leia in the margins, you know, learning about the Force and all that. But you don't really get to focus on her because ultimately this is Luke's story. So I understand why there wasn't really an opportunity to do it. I do still wish we had seen it. But yeah, I just kind of feel like if Luke had died on Cloud City, Obi-Wan and Yoda probably would have reached out to Leia. But when he survived and, you know, began to do some more training, I don't know that they necessarily needed to draw her away from her existing role as kind of the political and sort of moral heart of the rebellion.
Yeah, I guess, I don't know, I always wondered why that conversation was necessary if they never really do anything with Leia on that front. And like you said, I understand why, and I'm sure the fact that it was 1980/the early 80s also had something to do with it. But it always seems to me like they're building towards a reveal that there is another, but it's not that big of a reveal. So I don't know, it just sticks to me as an odd moment. But maybe I should just let go of that and accept that the limitations of storytelling plus the sexism of the early 80s. So
it could also be that they are trying to, you know, lay the groundwork for revealing that Leia is Luke's sister, right? I mean, we have to sort of think about this from the perspective of the 1980 audience. We obviously know now, and it's been known for 40 years, that they're siblings. But at that time, I'm sure some people suspected it, but it hadn't been confirmed yet. And so by saying, you know, there's another, followed by Leia obviously having Force powers, the audience then starts to think, okay, well, Leia has the Force. There's another person who can fulfill the role that Luke's supposed to be playing. Could she be that person? And if so, is she really a random Force user who found herself in the middle of all this? Or could she potentially be part of that family? Like, could there be a dynastic element to this? We know that in the pantheon of stories that fit this archetype, family is a big part of the sort of the through line of connecting the main characters, the legacy of a family. So it's not as if that would be unprecedented. So I'm tempted to see it as they were trying to lay the groundwork for people to then spend the next 3 years speculating about the connection there.
That is the argument that I would buy the most. Although then it's still weird that Leia kisses Luke in the beginning. But
well, and by the way, whatever. It's also weird that she kisses him on the mouth after that he gets rescued. When he's on the Falcon, he's healing up. He's got his arm in that little medical thing.
And then she kisses him on the mouth.
Fully on the mouth. Like, it was played as like a tender moment. Like, if it had been a kiss on the cheek, nobody would remark on it. But like, really? On the mouth? Like, you just told Han Solo that you love him. Are you having second thoughts about that?
Yeah, it's like, it also leads you to think, were they trying to build up this love triangle? And then, you know, actually she's his sister. Sometimes I like to put myself in the position of someone from 1980 who's like a Luke Leia shipper. And Empire comes out, and, you know, clearly Leia and Han have a thing, but, you know, it's okay. There's still hope for my ship because Luke and Leia had 2 kisses in this, and Leia clearly has a very deep connection to Luke.
And maybe Han's dead. Like, maybe he's just never going to come back.
Yeah, so it's all going to work out for me. They're going to be together. I truly believe this. And then 1983 rolls around, and they just be like, what the hell? I think that's very funny. RIP to you, Luke Layer shippers of the 80s.
Yeah, I feel like
for you.
Nobody had as rough of a 1980s at the movie theater as Luke Layer shippers. I feel like the next people to have that rough of a ride were Harry, Hermione shippers.
Yes, indeed.
But we won't even open that can of worms.
Thank you for going on that tangent with me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. By the way, we were talking about Vader and how he makes this offer to Luke to join forces. Do you think that, I mean, to me, trying to rewatch this and forget everything I know about what comes after this and what all the tie-in fiction that is set during this time period and all that, you know, this is kind of a radical idea in Empire Strikes Back to have Vader say, like, let's work together to defeat my boss. There's obviously the Emperor hints at it in their holographic transmission where he says, you know, he's a threat to us, right? And I feel like if you're the audience and you know at that point that, or you don't know that Vader is Anakin, you don't necessarily suspect that what the Emperor is saying is he's a threat because he's your son. He might tempt you away from me. All you know is what he's saying is he's a threat. And so you don't necessarily know why. But then when Vader reveals, oh, I am Anakin, so he's my son, then all of a sudden it's like, well, what was the Emperor worried about? And, you know, there isn't a lot of canon storytelling about the Emperor's perspective on this period of time. There is a story in the short story collection from a certain point of view where the Emperor senses that Vader has essentially had this mental shift into thinking about this potential to overthrow him. And that's really interesting. But obviously in 1980, all you know is this is the guy who goes around in the suit of armor and kills people for the Emperor, who has, you know, the lines that he has crossed for this shriveled old man are unprecedented. And now here he is saying, essentially saying, my allegiance to this guy is not absolute. And I am willing to take a chance on my son, who basically just learned how to levitate rocks, to overthrow him. I mean, that is such an interesting idea to me. It is such an interesting layer to Vader. And again, think about it from the perspective of the 1980 audience who has really never seen a villain like this before.
Yeah, I think there are two things point out there. First of all, something that I caught this time that I hadn't caught before, and partially only caught because I had now read from a certain point of view, was that it's pretty apparent that Vader knows Luke is Luke before the Emperor tells him. Like, I think at one point before his conversation with the Emperor, he even refers to Luke as Skywalker. So he knows that Luke is Luke, but then acts all surprised when the Emperor is like, oh, this is Anakin Skywalker's son. And Vader's like, what? Really? Whoa, who could have foreseen that? He does not actually say that. That would be pretty funny in James Earl
Who
Jones
could have
voice,
force
though.
Seen that?
Force
seen
that.
Yeah.
Yes. so there is that element of, he knew this, but was kind of keeping secrets from the Emperor. And then also, the second thing I will point out there, and this is with the hindsight of having watched the Revenge of the Sith, so obviously the 1980 audience had not done this, but the offer that he makes to Luke is very similar to the offer that he makes to Padme on Mustafar when he's like, I'm stronger than Palpatine now. You and I should team up. We'll rule the galaxy. It'll be great. And Padme rightfully is horrified and is saying, you know, you're going down a path I can't follow. But I think it very much shows that underneath that black armor lies an emotional heart, and that he still is unwilling to let go of his connections and still very strongly feels those bonds, before with his wife, now with his son, where he wants to believe that there's some version of the universe where he can have both, where he can have the family relationship and this great power over the galaxy. And the reality is that he can't. He can't have both. And in fact, he really has neither, because he doesn't have his family and he is a puppet to the Emperor. So I think that kind of underscores the tragedy of Vader as a character and of Anakin, is that he wants to have both things, but in the end, he has neither because, yeah.
I mean, there's an element of bargaining to it, right? I mean, he's on this dark path. He's working for Palpatine now, and Padme is like, you know, run away from all this. Stop this. This isn't you. And he's saying, like, it's me now. It has to be me now. I'm doing this for you. Come with me. Like, there's a certain patheticness to it, even right. as it is happening in this very fearsome context. You know, he's a powerful force user. She doesn't pose any physical threat to him, but he is still a pathetic person in that moment because of his refusal to acknowledge that he can't have both of those things. And then, obviously, Padme dies. Fast forward, he becomes Darth Vader, and then Luke comes into his life. And it's sort of reopening that old wound of, I'm on this path, I'm serving Palpatine, but maybe now I could have that family connection too. Maybe now I can really have both. It didn't work out before, but maybe with Luke, maybe I can have this now with Luke. And so it is, again, he's got the armor, he's got the James Earl Jones voice. It's all very scary and intimidating, but there is still an element of bargaining there where he's really, you know, I think an overlooked aspect of the scene is he really is trying to get Luke to step away from the ledge that is probably going to mean certain death as far as he's concerned, right. as far as Vader imagines. It's like, I don't want you to die. Come on, just please, just join me. We'll do this together. Do not fall off this ledge. Like, that is very much a real part of the scene. And it's, again, very interesting to look at Vader in this context as a person who is bargaining with someone after he's beaten him physically in a fight, and he is Darth Vader, the way we all think about Darth Vader, but he has this weakness that has come back and that is ultimately, as we know, going to tempt him completely away from the path that he has chosen.
Right. Yeah, he's a very emotional character, which is interesting, again, because of the armor and the voice, and you don't necessarily think of him that way, especially if you're a 1980 audience. This robotic character having that kind of depth of emotion, but a lot of his decisions are very emotionally charged, and you see that more beginning in this movie and then especially in Return of the Jedi.
You know, earlier at the beginning of the episode, I mentioned Lando, and I do want to ask you about Lando, because one of the things that I think is interesting is this is the first, as far as I'm concerned, the first conversation in the Star Wars fandom, if you're looking at, you know, release order, the actual real world chronology of how people interact with these movies, this is the first time that there is a big debate about should a character have done something. There's really not a lot of that in A New Hope, especially because Han, while he does leave, he comes back. I don't know that there's a moment in A New Hope that is comparable to Lando betraying Han. And given that by the end of the movie, they seem to be putting him on Team Good Guy. But again, nothing is certain there. I think we tend to look at these movies with a subconscious bias toward what we know happens next. But Lando was Han's friend, and then he betrayed him, and then he's back on the good side. But that doesn't mean anything permanent as far as 1980 is concerned. He could very easily be tempted again into betraying the rebellion if it's what he needs to do for his own safety. And so, you know, as far as I'm concerned, he's not solidly in Team Good Guy at the end of that movie from the 1980 perspective. But it's a very valid question when you have so much responsibility on your shoulders and the Empire shows up and you see a way to protect this, not just the institution that you've built, but also the people who rely on you. You sell out your friend, or do you stand on principle and possibly condemn, I don't know, the whole population of Cloud City to be destroyed? I mean, it is an interesting question, and unlike pretty much everything in A New Hope, it's not black and white, at least not to me, but what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I've always kind of been on Lando's side in this scenario, but also when I was watching this time around, it really struck me, like, Lando is Han if Han had actually been successful. So yeah, Lando is got his life together, basically, and he was a smuggler and a scoundrel and a no good kind of guy, and he was able to parlay his position into one of power, and now he's kind of gone straight and is running this city and has a lot of people that he is responsible for. And unlike Han, I think Lando grew up. Lando is what Han could be if Han grew up, but Han didn't grow up, Lando did. And he's making a kind of grown-up decision of, am I going to save my friend? Who, yeah, he's my friend, but he also, like, stole my ship, and I haven't seen him in 10 years, and he's also kind of a no-good scoundrel type character. Or do I take care of the thousands of people under my protection? And while there is some complexity to that decision, and you can see that Lando really wrestles with it, ultimately, I mean, I think he made the right decision. And it's a difficult one to make in that scenario, but I totally understand him trying to do the best for the people who are under his care. And then when the Empire reneges on it, the first thing he does is kind of sound the alarm, saying, you know, the Empire is taken over, everyone evacuate, just get out of here. Even in that time of tension, he is still thinking about the people under his care. So I think he's a really interesting character in this movie. And I think he kind of earns his badge as team good guy by the end, because you realize, you know, he was doing what he had to do. And once he realized that the Empire was going to go back on it, then he really did try his best to get Han back and also take care of Leia and Chewie. So yeah, I'm fully ensconced in Team Lando and Lando being a good guy by the end.
Yeah, I love what you said about Lando being Han if Han grew up, because in a sense, Lando's moral quandary is the direct and inevitable result of maturity and investment, right? I mean, Han's whole deal is, I am not getting involved in your rebellion. I'm in it for the money. I'm not getting attached to anything. This is obviously part of why his feelings for Leia scare him, is because that is going to draw him into a commitment, maybe not to the rebellion, but to her. And, you know, listen, if Lando doesn't get attached to being respected, having authority, and you know, having people look to him for help, then there's no way that Vader can put the squeeze on him, right? Vader can't leverage him for anything. But yeah, he has responsibility and he has attachments. And that puts him in a predicament that Han at this moment doesn't really face. I don't know that, you know, it's hard for me to say I'm Team Lando only because so much of what happens after he makes the deal just seems so predictable to me. Like, did you really think Vader was going to keep his end of the deal and let, you know, two of the most notorious rebels just hang out with you and not have any Imperial, like, garrison stay behind to make sure everything is in tip-top shape? I don't know that I would have believed that if I were Lando, but you're right. In the movie, he obviously is taken aback by the betrayal on Vader's part, and once he starts to get the sense that, you know, not just, okay, I did something morally questionable by betraying my friend, but also this isn't going to be as stable and contained of a deal as I thought it was, and now these other people are also potentially in mortal peril, then it's, you know, he goes to Lobot and they turn the tables on the Imperials, and only at that point does he start to sort of see the light, and he helps, you know, Chewie and Leia get away. But even, you know, as you point out, even while he's doing that, he takes the time to ensure that his people can, you know, can make the decisions for themselves about, you know, trying to get away. And, you know, thankfully, Ice Cream Maker Guy is able to, you know, save the ice cream maker and hopefully, you know, get off planet with the ice cream.
And make lots more ice cream.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think, too, just looking at it from Lando's perspective, like, your friend that you haven't seen in 10 to 15 years rolls up in the equivalent of, like, a beat-up Toyota Camry 1992 that he stole from you, essentially, and like showing up with his old friend and some 22-year-old, and you're like, okay, yeah, of course this guy is the same as he's always been. And right. If Darth Vader, you know, the scariest guy in the Empire aside from the Emperor himself, wants to have him, then yeah, sure, whatever. I mean, that sucks for me to give up my old friend, but clearly, you know, there's nothing too new about him.
I just have to remember to stay in touch with you more than once every 10 years then.
Yeah, exactly, because otherwise I will betray you.
First opportunity, just instantly.
And I will have no qualms about it either.
And you will take my Toyota Camry and my favorite vest, and you will just...
Yeah, I mean, if you took my Toyota Camry and then 10 years from now showed up and had it in terrible condition, I mean, I would be annoyed. But anyway, I also think there's a little bit of wishful thinking on Lando's part, because, I mean, it seems pretty obvious that the Empire is not going to hold up its end of the deal, but he's just trying to do his best and hoping that it'll work out. And then, of course, it doesn't work out because it's not going to work out. It was never going to work out. But I do think I'm able to excuse some of that dumb decision making because he's just having wishful thinking there.
I mean, yeah, he's in over his head. He has a lot of people who are looking to him, and once he realizes that he basically has to do this in order to protect them, then there's, you know, the self-justification kicks in of, well, okay, but at least Leia and Chewie will be safe. Like, I will be able to watch over them here. They're not going to be hurt. And so, yeah, I really have to do this. It's the best thing for Leia and Chewie. Otherwise, they're just going to get, you know, taken by the Empire. Like, I could see it from his perspective a little bit there.
Yeah.
You know, you mentioned this in our notes about how Empire really does end on a very down note that is kind of whiplash from the ending of A New Hope. And everybody talks about how it's the middle chapter, the depressing movie, the one where things are not looking up. But when you start a franchise with A New Hope and the fairy tale mythology that is woven throughout it, and it's not like everybody lives happily ever after at the end of that movie, but structurally it ends on what could be considered a localized high note, even if it's in the context of a grim situation because the Empire has not been defeated. But yeah, you have this pretty upbeat ending, and then you come to Empire Strikes Back, and man, that is whiplash 3 years later, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a real downer of an ending to go from a medal ceremony to one of the three main characters is unaccounted for. The main character has just been served a crushing emotional and physical blow. And the Empire seems in just as much power as it was before, if not more. And it's really kind of unclear where to go from there for the rebellion, other than we know that Lando and Chewie are going to go off looking for Han. But for the rebellion as a whole, it seems kind of like they're at a loss because they were very much, they barely survived Hoth at the beginning. And then the story branches off away from the rebellion to focus on Leia and Han and Chewie and Luke's stories respectively. But you're still very much at a point where it's kind of like, where do we go from here? Because things are looking pretty grim, and it is definitely a big change from the triumphant medal ceremony where, yeah, the bad guy's not totally defeated, but we killed the Death Star and things are going well, too. The Empire is in a lot of power and we are physically and emotionally beaten down. So it really is a big change.
And I'm guessing that you, as somebody who didn't like the medal ceremony and the idea of, like, calling out these three people and giving them medals, were probably pretty happy that there was no, you know, medal ceremony at the end of this movie, you know, for the Battle of Hoth or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, it would be tonally weird to have a medal ceremony after
just
all
in
that.
The background of the med bay, like Mon Mothma very quietly, very respectfully just handing out medals, like keeping everybody away from the main characters who are having their moment at the window, but like, you know, handing out gold, silver, and bronze to, you know, the Rogue Squadron pilots who survived.
Good for them. You know, I hope they did get medals privately. It's not filmed. They got their medals outside of the movie. But no, I like it. I like that complexity and that kind of a downbeat note. But I think the reason I like it is partially, as you were saying, we have this subconscious bias of knowing what comes next. So I am kind of pleased with this downbeat note, knowing that in Return of the Jedi, it's all going to work out and we're going to end with dancing Ewoks and seeing happy Force ghosts. But if I had been a member of the audience in 1980, I probably would have been pretty bummed, you know, like, well, that was a real downer compared to the last one. But I also would have been really ready for that third movie. So I don't know. I think it does more to entice a viewer to want to watch the next one than the end of A New Hope, because at the end of A New Hope, it's kind of like, okay, we've hit a nice concluding point and we can tie a little bow. And if there had never been another movie after that, I think it, like, you could have been fine with just that one movie. But after the end of Empire Strikes Back, it's clear that there has to be another movie because it's just too open-ended.
Yeah, and obviously part of that is, you know, they knew they would be making a third one, whereas, you know, when they were making A New Hope, they didn't know they were making a second one. And I think even, you know, as avant-garde as George Lucas was, he knew that he could not in good conscience end that movie on a cliffhanger when he didn't know whether he'd ever be able to make the next one. But yes, it is certainly more enticing to wonder how they're gonna pull their way out of this scrape. It's really interesting to also try to imagine what people might be guessing about in their heads. I think this is another example of where it's impossible to go back and pretend that you haven't seen Return of the Jedi, or even that you know about the existence of the sequel trilogy where all those characters are alive, and sort of pretend like you don't know what's going to happen next, because, you know, the imagination is a fertile place, and the only people who can really speak to that are, you know, the people who were actually in the theater watching at the time, or I guess people who somehow have not heard about any of the later Star Wars content and are just watching this movie for the first time. I would love to know what people like that think is going to happen next. but yeah, you know who else deserves a medal? The production designer on this movie, because the landscapes that we see in Empire are so much better.
So good.
Than what we get in A New Hope. And there's a reason for that, obviously, is that they're now more invested in building this thing out. They have a little bit more money to play with. But that being said, just very impressive, objectively, to look at how they were able to make these places look so good, especially Dagobah. I don't know if all of our listeners have seen the set photos and just how compressed that space was relative to what it looks like. But they made great use of the Ralph McQuarrie concept paintings that are in the background of pretty much all those shots. And with the exception of like one painting of Bespin, that's like almost a transition shot with no like live action elements in it, they all pretty much hold up, mostly because they're all in the background, not the foreground. But like it does look like a much bigger space, pretty much all of these locations than they actually had.
Yeah. And I will say that even the painting of Bespin, I love, because it's just, the aesthetic is so good. So even though it's obviously like not real, I think it's still beautiful. And I also have to give a little shout out to my boyfriend, who was watching this movie with me. And when it opened on Hoth, he said, and it was very funny, so I wrote it down, quote, "Ah, Hoth, the most iconic of the Battlefront 2 maps." So
I was thinking that when I was watching this. You know, it's funny. I was this movie has some of the most memorable music in the original trilogy, and there are several tracks where I'm like, yep, I remember when you get to that part of Battlefront. I remember when you hear this music. Like, yep, this is the part of that one, you know, Shadows of the Empire video game. Like, it's so funny to go back to where that stuff actually came from, because it doesn't evoke the movie as I'm watching it. It evokes all these later experiences.
Yeah, I thought that was very funny, too. I don't play the video games, but my boyfriend is a big Battlefront 2 fan, so I'm sure there are many of you out there, and also appreciate Hoth for that purpose as well.
Before we go, I do just want to point out a couple of things. First, obviously, R2-D2 is the hero of this movie. He saves the day about 600 times. This is also, interestingly, the only movie where he makes a mistake. He plugs into the wrong kind of outlet and ends up getting electrocuted. Everybody makes mistakes. I did just want to point it out in the interest of transparency, but he is still a perfect little boy, and we all love him very much, and he does save the day many times in this movie. The other thing is, and sort of a little bit more seriously, like, we need more Lobot. I feel like this movie, it has very few of them, but there are characters in this movie who are sort of second tier, third tier. They're definitely there. They're around the main characters, but they don't do much, but you still want to know more about them. Most people think of the bounty hunters. Right. We barely talked about them because I think, unlike a lot of people, I'm not particularly taken by the bounty hunters just on looks. I love what Tim Morrison is doing now with Boba Fett in the Disney Plus stuff, but like before all that, I was not like a big like bounty hunter guy. But Lobot is just so interesting to me, partly because he's got the cyborg implant, he's clearly Lando's right-hand man, and he doesn't speak, right? So there's a mystery to him. You want to know what's going through his head. And I think we need more Lobot. There was a comic that talked a little bit about how that situation came to be, but man, Lobot, what a great, you know, what a guy.
Yeah, shout out to Lobot.
The other thing I will say before we wrap up is, for those of you who are a fan of Admiral Ackbar, who we meet in the next movie, and his famous line, "It's a trap," just want to point out that Leia got there first, folks. She actually was the first person in Star Wars to say, "It's a trap." So,
yes,
blink and you'll miss it, but it's there in The Empire Strikes Back.
When she shouts to Luke, as Luke is on Cloud City, and Leia shouts, "It's a trap! It's a trap!"
Oh, I was hoping that we would like leave it a mystery and they would have to rewatch the movie and find it. But, you know, I suspect that our listeners probably know exactly where that is in the movie.
Yeah. We do not cater to the casual fans. We're here for the hardcore nerds.
Yeah, if you're listening to this and you did not know where in the movie Leia said, "It's a trap," you know what? Welcome. We're glad that you found Hoth Takes. Thank you for listening. Well, that's going to do it for this episode. Thanks to everyone for tuning in. If you want to share your thoughts about our show, suggest topics for future episodes, you can do that at our email address, hothtakes@gmail.com, or on Twitter, @hothtakes. You can follow us individually on Twitter as well. I'm @Eric Geller. Grace is @Grace_Seegers. And Haley is @Birdinator. And again, congratulations to her on the birth of her son. Haley, who I just mentioned, is responsible for our wonderful logo and banner art. I edited this episode and put together our music. As always, we got to point out, for legal purposes, Lucasfilm owns all those themes and sound effects. We are not trying to do any trademark infringement here. If you want to listen to a complete archive of the past episodes of this show, you can do that at hothtakes.wordpress.com. And if you like the show, please share it with a friend. Tell them to subscribe on iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or Stitcher. That is it for us in this episode. We will see you next time. May the Force be with you.